What are Robert Quinlan and his wife feebly arguing about when the homeless man slips quietly in? Moments later, Robert could hardly have said, Obamacare or quinoa or their granddaughter's new boyfriend, something. He and Darla are sitting at a table in the dining area of the New Leaf Co-op. Her back is to the man. Robert is facing him. He notices him instantly, though the man is making eye contact with none of the scattered few of them, the health-conscious members of the co-op dining by the pound from the hot buffet. It's a chilly North Florida January twilight, but he's still clearly overbundled, perhaps from the cold drilling deeper into his bones because of a life lived mostly outside, or perhaps he simply needs to carry all his clothes around with him. Robert takes him for a veteran. The man's shoulder-length hair is shrapnel gray. His face is deep-creased and umbered by street life. But in spite of the immediately apparent state of his present situation, he stands straight with his shoulders squared. He sits down at a table beside the partition doorway, which gapes into the crosswise aisle between checkout counters and front entrance. He slumps forward ever so slightly and puts his clenched fists on the tabletop. He stares at them. You should have put your curry on it, Darla says to Robert. So it's about quinoa, the argument. Instead of rice, she says. She has continued her insistent advocacy while his attention has drifted over her shoulder to the vet. Robert brings his eyes back to her. He tries to remember if he has already cited the recent endorsement of white rice by some health journal or other. All those famously healthy Japanese eat rice, he says. She huffs. He looks at his tofu curry on the biodegradable paper plate. He looks back to the vet, who has opened one fist and is placing a small collection of coins on the table. I'm just trying to keep you healthy, Darla says. Which is why I'm content to be here at all, Robert says, though he keeps his eyes on the vet. The man opens the other fist and begins pushing the coins around, sorting them. It's done in a small, quiet way, no show about it at all. Thanks to their fish, she says. Robert returns to Darla. Her eyes are the cerulean blue of a Monet sky. Fish, he asks, uncomprehendingly. Yes, she says, that's the factor. He leans toward her, perhaps a bit too abruptly. He stops her explanation and her blue eyes widen a little. I should feed him, he says, low. She blinks and gathers herself. Who? He nods in the vet's direction. She peeks over her shoulder. The man is still pushing his coins gently around. She leans to Robert, lowering her voice. I didn't see him. He just came in, Robert says. Feed him quinoa, Darla says. She isn't kidding. Please, he says, rising. She shrugs. This isn't a thing Robert often does, never with money. He carries the reflex attitude learned in childhood. You give a guy like this money and it will go for drink, which just perpetuates his problems. There are organizations he can find if he really wants to take care of himself. Giving food is another matter, he figures. But to give food to somebody you encounter on the street while rafting the momentum of your daily life, that's usually an awkward thing to pull off. And so, in those rare cases when it wouldn't be awkward, you can easily overlook the chance. But here is a chance he's noticed. And there's something about this guy that continues to suggest veteran, which is to say, a Vietnam veteran, something. He is of an age, of a certain bearing, of a field radio frequency that you're always tuned to in your head. Robert is a veteran. He doesn't go straight for the vet's table. He heads toward the doorway, which would bring him immediately alongside him. He draws near. The man has finished arranging his coins, but continues to ponder them. He does not look up. Then Robert is beside him, as if about to pass through the doorway. The vet has to be aware of him now. Still, he does not look. He has no game going in order to get something, this man of needs. It has truly been about sorting the coins. He smells a little musty, but not overpoweringly so. He's taking care of himself pretty well, considering, or has done so recently at least. Robert stops. The vet's hair, which was a cowl of gray from across the room, up close has a seam of coal black running from crown to collar. Robert puts his hand on the man's shoulder. He bends near him. The man is turning, lifting his face, and Robert says, "Would you like some food?" Their eyes meet. The furrows of the vet's face at brow and cheek and jaw retain much of their first impression, deeply defined from hard times and a hard life in the body. But his eyes seem clear, and they crimp now at the outer edges. "Yes," he says. "Do you have some?" "I can get you some," Robert says. "That would be good," the man says. "Yes. What do you like?" "I think there was some chicken." Though he hasn't invoked the preternaturally healthful quinoa, he catches himself trying to manage this guy's nutrition, an impulse which feels uncomfortably familiar. He's trying to get him healthy. "It needs to be soft," the man says. "I don't have very many teeth." "Why don't you come with me?" Robert says. "You can choose." The vet is quick to his feet. "Thank you," he says. He offers a closed mouth smile. Standing with him now, about to walk with him, Robert recognizes something he's neglected. This act is still blatant charity, condescending in its anonymity. So he offers his hand. And though he almost always calls himself and always thinks of himself as Robert, he says, "Bob." The vet hesitates. The name alone seems to have thrown him. Robert clarifies, "I'm Bob." The man takes Robert's hand and smiles again, more broadly this time, but struggling to keep his toothlessness from showing. "I'm Bob," he says. And then hastily, as if he'd be mistaken for simply madly parroting the name, "Two." The handshake goes on. The vet has a firm grip. He further clarifies, "I'm also Bob." "It's a good name," Robert says. "It's okay. Not as common as it used to be." Bob looks at Robert for a moment, letting the handshake slow and stop. Robert senses a shifting of the man's mind into a conversational gear that hasn't been used in quite a while. That's true," Bob says. Robert leads him through the doorway and along the partition, past the 10 items only register, and into a buffet area. He stops at the soup warmers on the end cap, thinking of the man's tooth problem, but Bob goes on ahead, and before Robert can make a suggestion, Bob says, "They have beans and rice. That's good." Robert steps beside him, and together they peer through the sneeze guard at a tub of pintos and a tub of brown rice. Good mess hall food, Robert thinks. Though thinking of it that way jars with a reassessment going on in a corner of his mind, of no relevance to this present intention, however. Bob declines any other food, and Robert piles one of the plastic dinner plates high with beans and rice, while Bob finds a drink in the cooler. Robert waits for him and takes the bottle of lightly lemon sparkling water from his hand and says, "Why don't you go ahead and sit?" Bob nods and slips away. Robert steps to the nearby checkout station. A young man with a jugular sunburst tattoo and a silver ring pierced into his lip totals up the food, and Robert lets his reassessment register in his mind. From the clues of age in face and hair, Robert realizes Bob is no Vietnam veteran. As old as the man is, perhaps 50 or 55, he is still too young to have been in Vietnam. He missed it by a decade or so. Robert pays. The clerk gives him a small, understanding nod. "Do you know him?" Robert asks. "He comes now and then," the young man says. Beans and rice and fizzy lemon water in hand, Robert turns away. He steps into the dining area and sets the plate and the can before Bob. The man has carefully laid out his napkin and plastic utensils and has put his coins away. He squares around to look up at Robert. He is not the man Robert first thought him to be. "Thank you," Bob says. Robert knows nothing about him. "It's a good meal," Bob says. "You bet," Robert says. And he moves off, thinking, "It would have made no difference. I would have done this anyway." He sits down before Darla. She leans toward him and says softly, "I'm glad you did that." To her credit, she does not ask what he's bought the man. She sits back. Her plate, once featuring the spicy Thai quinoa salad, is empty. He looks at his remaining tofu curry. He picks up his fork and begins pushing it around. She says something he does not quite hear. He stops pushing. There are other voices in the dining area, conversations. He thinks, can it have been that long ago? But of course it can. Even consciously thinking about it, Vietnam yields up no clear individual memory. Images are there, faces and fields and a headquarters compound courtyard and a bar and a bed and a river. But they are like thumbnails of forgotten snaps on a cell phone screen. "More," Darla says. As part of other things she's been saying, no doubt, Robert looks at her. She narrows her eyes at him. "It's probably cold," she says, nodding at his food. "Probably," he says. "You can get some more," she says. "I don't need anything," he says. She shrugs. "Shall we go?" "Coffee," he says. The word is a nanosecond or so ahead of the conscious thought. She cocks her head. He went back to the stuff a few months ago after she'd wrangled a year of abstinence from him. She was reconciled to it, but the one-word announcement sounds like a taunt, he realizes. "Bob needs some coffee," he says. "Bob?" She twists at the word in her snorty voice, assuming he's referring to his coffee-seeking self in the third person. She occasionally calls him Bob when she thinks he's behaving badly. He doesn't explain. He rises. He approaches Bob. The man is hunched over his food, wolfing it in. Robert is beside him before he looks up. "You a coffee drinker, Bob?" "I surely am," he says. "How do you take it?" "With a splash of milk. I'll get you some." "I appreciate it, Bob," Bob says. Near the buffet, Robert begins to fill a cup from a percolator urn. Framed in the center of the urn is the bag art for today's brew. An upsweep of mountains dense with tropical forest, the vista framed in coffee trees. Somewhere along the highway to Dak Tho, they'd laid out the beans to dry. He is passing in a jeep, heading to an assignment that will quickly be changed, sending him up country. A pretty-faced girl in a conical hat, leaning on her coffee rake, lifts her face to him, and he sweeps on past. The cup is nearly full. He flips up the handle. He splashes in some milk. He returns to Bob. The man thanks him again, briefly cupping both hands around the coffee, taking in its warmth before setting it down. "You a Floridian, Bob?" Robert asks. "I'm from Charleston, West Virginia," he says. "Good thing you're not up there for the winter." Bob nods a single firm nod and looks away. I have to go back," he says. "Perhaps when things warm up." "No choice," he says. "I've got responsibilities." His face remains averted. He isn't elaborating. His beans and rice are getting cold. Robert still has the urge to make this encounter count for something beyond a minor act of charity. Learn a bit more about him, offer some advice, whatever. And this is all he can think to ask. What sort of responsibilities, Bob? Bob doesn't look at him. He doesn't eat. He doesn't drink. Robert has made the man go absolutely still. But Robert sloughs off the niggle of guilt, thinking he's probably been asserting these responsibilities to himself for the whole long slide to where he is now, knowing there's nothing left where he came from, knowing he'll never go back. Robert puts his hand on Bob's shoulder for a moment and then moves away. He does not sit down at their table. Darla looks up. She glances at his empty hands. No coffee? He shrugs. She nods and smiles. Finished with dinner? Yes, he says. She gathers her things and they put on their coats. She leads the way across the floor. Darla may well glance at Bob as she passes, ready to offer him an encouraging smile. She would do that. But Bob looks up only after she's gone by. He fixes his eyes on Robert's and upticks his chin. He says, "You know my old man, is that it?" Robert takes the odd abruptness of the question in stride, answering a passing no as he follows Darla out of the dining area. And that is that. Okay, so at this point, the novel follows Bob for a time. He will become a very important character in the book. But for now, I want to skip ahead to a scene later the same evening. Perfume River is at its heart about the boomer generation, its families and its wars. But only one shot is fired in the present time in the book, which is 2015, and only two shots are fired in memory. The novel is, as well, about secrets in families, only some of which have to do with war. And the novel's about how the past is always with us, always in deep dialogue with the present. In this passage I'm going to read now, Robert and Darla are about to sleep. Robert is about to encounter a crucial memory, the font of two of his secrets. They will expand in him through the novel. In bed now, Darla inserts her iPod earbuds, and she and Robert switch off their lamps. Their Kindles have their own light. The tinny spill of Bach from his wife's ears fades quickly from Robert's awareness. Soon, however, he is reading the same few sentences over and over. He turns off his book. "Good night," she says, aware of the vanishing of his light in her periphery. "Good night," he says, though they have long ago agreed that the formality of his reply is unnecessary, since her head, at this point, is always full of music and she cannot hear him. Nor do they kiss. They are so very familiar with each other, and that familiarity has become the presiding expression of their intimacy. Robert sleeps. And he wakes. He's been dreaming, but he does not remember a single image of the dream. Not that he tries. It is enough that he is awake. The room is dark. He turns his face toward Darla. He can make out, more kinesthetically than visually, the topography of her. She's lying on her side, facing away. He gently pulls back the covers, ekes his way from the bed so as not to disturb her, puts on slippers and robe, and he goes out of the room and along the hallway and down the stairs. He pulls his top coat as well from the vestibule closet, enters the wide dark of the living room, and passes through the French doors and onto the rear veranda. He stands at its edge. The moonless sky is clear, and the stars are bright. His bare ankles are cold, but his chest is warm. He once would have snuck a smoke here. He didn't need Darla to persuade him to abandon cigarettes, even an isolated open-air smoke or two. His father's burr grinder cough did that. Now he simply puffs his breath into the starlight. His live oak stands before him in vast silhouette, its lower horizontal branches thick as most trees, thick as water oaks or pin oaks. On other nights, with or without cigarettes, he felt that his scholarly discipline, his life's work, his very mind were made manifest in this tree. After all, it stood there through early 20th century America, breathing oxygen into that era's air. It even likely witnessed the birth and death of the Confederacy, perhaps even Andrew Jackson's war on the Seminoles, Old Hickory's ruthlessness thwarted by the tribe's guerrilla elusiveness. But on this night, Robert folds his arms across his chest and squares himself to the oak. He feels the presence not of the ghosts of history, but of Bob. Bob, the illusory Vietnam veteran. He evoked Vietnam over Robert's quinoa at the health food store, and then, being illusory in that regard, couldn't vent the war away. So it is settled back into Robert himself. For this, the veranda facing the oak tree is the wrong place to be tonight. A tree sits in the center of Robert's Vietnam. He unfolds his arms, thinks to turn, to retreat to bed, but he does not move. Instead, he wakes, and it's dark, and a woman is beside him, naked and small. And she's waking too, and the room is still heavy with the incense, and she is burned for her dead. Robert has lingered with her, fallen asleep with her in a back street on the south bank of the Perfume River in the city of Hue. It is 3:40 in the morning, January 31st, 1968, and they have woken to the sound of the North Vietnamese rockets and mortar rounds coming in from the mountains to the west. Robert blinks hard against this memory. He will not let certain things in. He pats his pockets now, by reflex, as if he will find a cigarette, and he turns his face a little, breaking with his live oak. But the woman lingers, still naked, in the dark of the room, lit through the window by a distant flare from across the rooftops. And now he is throwing on his clothes. Hue was supposed to be different, traditionally spared by both sides. The targets of the North's New Year's offensive were thought surely to have been revealed in the fighting that commenced this time yesterday. Surely it was all coordinated. He is dressed, and he and the woman are standing beside the bed. Her name is Lian. Lotus. She hands him something heavy. Metal. He knows the thing. It is a French 32 caliber pistol that belonged to her father. Do Robert and the woman speak? Of course they do. He loves her. But he will not remember more of her now. And he is down the back stairs into the dead fish stench of the alley. The AK-47s are popping from across the river. The Viet Cong, or maybe even the North Vietnamese regulars. Though his job has been to count men, weapons, from all the field intelligence that comes in, he thinks, we don't know jack shit about them for all our counting. He goes out into the street, and far down in the street lamps along the river, he sees the men moving. The men he counts. He thinks, I am a dead man. He turns and runs in the direction of MACV, the U.S. compound, half a dozen blocks away. He rushes past storefronts and the passageways into rear courtyards and past the smells of mildew and dead fish and the smell of wood fires. And from all directions now comes the din of weaponry, of small arms and RPDs and the whoosh and suck and blare of rockets, the sky flaring across the river beyond the Imperial Palace walls. They're heading Taylock, the city airport, to the north. And now he sees men before him as well, a squad of dark-clothed men. a block up the river, and gunfire is crackling everywhere. And now a needle-thin compression of air zips past his head, and he lunges into an alley mouth, and he's running hard, and figures are coming to doorways, and he thinks the local communist cadres are emerging. He thinks again that he is dead, and there is only darkness around him, and the alley slime underfoot, and he pushes hard, and if he is to die, he'd rather not see it happening, so he doesn't look right or left or feel any of the bodies coming out. He just runs, and he runs, and he is out of the alley, and he is in a pocket park and standing before a great dark form. A banyan tree. It is old and it is vast. Its aerial roots are thick as young trees and nuzzled together into their own dense forest, propping up a billowing dark sky of leaves. And there is a deep inner curve to the roots and a turning. And in the direction of the MacVie compound, there is heavy small arms fire now. And he hears the AK-47s, and he hears an answering M60 machine gun and the M16s, and he knows what to do. He enters the tree. He moves into the turning, and he puts his back to its roots, and he sits, and he draws his legs into him, and he is in the dark. He can see around the outcurving columns of roots. Bodies appear, nearly as dark as the night, moving quickly past with a metallic rustle of weapons. And he pulls his head back, squeezes it into himself. He closes his eyes and smells a dank, wet earth smell and something fainter beneath, an almost sweetness and a little sharp thing in the nose. And he thinks of the girl's incense and the dead she prays for. He knows this tree has killed another to live. These roots around him, holding him in the dark, began long ago by wrapping themselves around another tree, the strangler roots, embracing a living tree until it vanished, until it was dead inside the growing banyan. Rifles flare nearby, and he presses back into the killing embrace of the banyan. He holds the French pistol in his right hand, flat against his chest. He expects to die here. Robert steps from his veranda. He is panting heavily. He has not let this happen for several years. He moves across his lawn now, approaches his tree. He places both hands hard upon its trunk to stop their trembling. He leans heavily there, waiting for this to pass.